The COVID-19 pandemic has created an emotional roller coaster for kids and parents alike.
Today on Real Family Talk, we'll talk about how families can survive and thrive under these unprecedented conditions. Join us.
In a recent New York Times article, a 22-year-old business student in France shares, "The pandemic feels like a big stop in our lives." She added, "One that puts us so low that I wonder, what's the point?"
Dr. Nicholas Frank, the head of a psychiatric network in Lyon, France, conducted a survey of 30,000 people last spring. Young people ranked the lowest in psychological well-being. He said and shares, "We are in the midst of a mental health pandemic, and I don't think it's treated with nearly enough respect."
Here to discuss issues on the mental health pandemic is Dr. Julianne Melgosa, a psychologist who serves as the Associate Director for the Education Department at the General Conference of Seventh-day Adventists at the World Headquarters. Julianne holds a degree in psychology from the University of Madrid and a doctorate in educational psychology from Andrews University. Welcome, Dr. Melgosa.
Happy to be here.
Tell us how the pandemic is affecting the mental health of students of all ages.
It is affecting in many ways. I received data from the American Psychological Association recently. This organization commissioned a poll from the Harris Poll and indicates that young and old both are being affected in many ways. The top ways are, number one, unwanted variations of their weight. This has effects on mental health if you gain undesirable weight or if you lose undesirable weight. Also, coping inadequately with stress. People are coping, for example, drinking, particularly alcohol. Or those who don't drink, they are using hypercaloric foods, or using behaviors that are inadequate, like gaming or shopping online. Recently, a friend told me that his 8-year-old used a family credit card without permission to make purchases in internet. So it's affecting in many ways. People are not getting their desired amount of sleep, and sleep and mental health are closely related. So parents have to be facing this on themselves and in connection with their children. And sometimes, unfortunately, this develops into a full syndrome, and this may translate into depression or anxiety or addiction, particularly individuals that are prone to it.
Wow.
It sounds like it's a really difficult situation. I'm wondering, do people understand the extent of disorders such as anxiety, depression, and addictions?
Well, some people do and some people don't. The most common misunderstandings have to do with believing that while organic illness is real, mental illness is imaginary. And this is a big error, to classify mental illness as something that it is within your head or something that is not serious enough and you can take care of just changing your attitude. So children and teenagers have to be taught how to deal with this prejudice about mental illness. And they have to understand that suffering from, say, depression is going to be more on the blame side, and they have to change their attitude and think of depression as they think of diabetes, for example. So that is the kind of misunderstanding that we have. And of course, the reluctance to search for a mental health practitioner, the same way that it's very easy to go to your general practice searching for the doctor. Not so many people feel confident to go to the psychiatrist or the clinical psychologist.
Yeah. So what do you think families can do to overcome this stigma? Because there is a stigma in society. And whereas someone might go to the oncologist if they have cancer, or to the dentist if they have a toothache, or just to their primary care physician, for some reason, there's just a stigma. And particularly, I think, in communities of faith. And so what can we do as mental health professionals, or even as church leaders, pastors, to help families have a better understanding of mental health in general?
Yes, thank you for that question. It's a very important one, because we all contribute to consolidate those prejudices. And just the responses that we give when we hear that someone is discouraged, that someone is not feeling well, and we say, well, does it hurt anything? No, I just don't feel well. That can be the sign of a minor depression or even major depression. And our reaction is going to make a lot of difference. Those who blame someone because he's feeling discouraged is contributing to that kind of belief. People need to understand better. We all have to remind ourselves that mental disorders are disorders just like physical ones. Both physical disorders and mental disorders have a component that is physical and a component that is psychological. Whenever I have a physical problem, in my digestive symptom is not only organic, it's also mental, in the sense that the attitude, the belief, the hope, the desire to get well will count as much as the medication. And likewise, in the case of a mental disease, it has an organic background. There are changes in the levels of hormones or neurotransmitters in the central nervous system because of emotions. And at the same time, my choice of thinking, my choice of behavior will make a difference also in how this discomfort evolves. So we need to understand that mental health, physical health, they are not really that different. They both have an organic component. They both have a psychological component, and we don't have to treat them differently in attitude.
That is really interesting. The fact that the body is a unit, and the fact that what ails us physically will also impact us emotionally. There is a reality, and it's, well, it makes us know that human beings are part of a whole. Yeah. And that we have to be paying attention to all of these different aspects of our lives, and that the physical is not really separated from the emotional, but they go hand in hand. Yes.
Yeah.
Because when you have a physical ailment, it has an impact on your emotional well-being as well. So well said, and thank you so much for sharing that. After a short break, Dr. Melgosa will discuss ways to stay mentally healthy during the pandemic and beyond. Stay with us. Studies carried out during the pandemic suggest that although some families are coping well, others are facing financial adversity, struggling to homeschool, and are at risk for experiencing vicious cycles of increasing distress.
Possible mental health conditions increased from 10.8% in 2017 to 16% in July 2020 across all age, sex, and ethnic groups, according to England's Mental Health of Children and Young People Survey. A self-selected sample of 2,673 parents recruited through social media reported deteriorating mental health and increased behavioral problems among children ages 4 to 11 years between March and May 2020 during lockdown. Dr. Melgosa, tell us what your recommendations are to prevent these dangerous effects.
Well, first, we have to differentiate between mild temporary symptoms and significant incapacitating symptoms. The first one are susceptible to be dealt with via self-help and prevention measures. And those are the ones that I would like to mention. When we suspect that there is a clinical case, we need to seek professional help. So talking about self-help, what is what we can do in order to prevent or to diminish the effect of these symptoms that are mild in nature? One of the things that I have mentioned is to work on the quality of sleep. Bad sleep is both the cause and the consequence of mental illness. So we need to be very careful about sleeping sufficient time, providing the environment that will help us sleep better. Do not work during the times, or do not use screen activity with devices during the time or right before we go to bed. This is important to protect our sleep. The home atmosphere in general. A home should be a place where people are able to talk, to share, to listen, to be encouraged, to find a refuge. That is a good preventive measure. Social interaction, not only in the home, but outside of the home, also promote some safe encounters. These days, of course, through internet or through other devices to promote this social connection that is so important for mental health. Just recently, a friend from Brazil was telling me, I have my children working with another two children in the garage. They themselves have made a little station so that they do the homework together. No more, and are with the masks and so on. Mm. That way they satisfy the social need. There are ways that we can do that. Physical activity, oh, that's a wonderful thing. If you can, at home or in outdoors, do physical activity, the one that will tire you, that will do wonders for your mental health. There is so much evidence about the benefits of physical activity. And finally, I will say mental attitude. Learning to appreciate the positive side of things, learning how to motivate or encourage oneself when one is a little down, learning to be tolerant of the difference that we naturally will have with other people, learning to calm down oneself to prevent a burst of anger, and see that we can connect with other people in positive ways. These are some of the mental attitudes. And of course, we are going to talk a little later about something very important, which is spiritual coping, how we use religion, spirituality to cope with challenges of mental disease.
Yeah, you know, I want to point out something that you said, and the two go hand in hand, sleep and physical activity. And so it's interesting that you mentioned that physical activity would actually help with sleep. And we know that, we learned that a long time ago. We had a physician at one of our congregations where Willie pastored. And I remember being a young professional and a young mom, and just telling him one Sabbath that I was having difficulty sleeping. And he asked me if I was exercising. And I said, well, I don't have time to exercise. And so he was just saying, well, if you add, you know, 30 minutes, 20 minutes of exercise, somewhat relatively rigorous exercise, it would actually help sleep. And so these self-help tips that you've shared are really way more helpful, I think, than people realize. And I hope that our viewers will take them to heart.
So we have another question for you, and is what to do if parents of young people themselves suspect that their child is reaching pathological levels? What should they do?
I am very happy to answer this question, because we want to make clear that people should do something about it. A problem of mental health is nothing to be left there because it's going to go away. This is not going to happen most of the times. So we need to seek professional help if we suspect that this is reaching pathological levels. We have to talk to the primary physician to get a referral, or go directly to a clinical psychologist or a psychiatrist and explain what the symptoms are so that people can devise some treatment plan. these professions are also perceived as negative, sometimes shameful. So we need to take our child or our adolescent to a mental health service, and we have to prepare them to accept that mental health is nothing ugly, nothing shameful. You go to the dermatologist, you go to the traumatologist. If you have a rash or if your arms have been broken, you don't have any problem. The same thing, you should go to the psychiatrist if you have needs in your mind or your behavior. There are some people that have prejudice toward medication. Medication has saved lives. People who have a full major depression and they have been prescribed antidepressants, they have been saved their lives because of suicide prevention. Medicines will not take care of the problem. Everybody knows that, but it will stabilize. So we need to remove that stigma towards medication. We also need to check if there is psychotherapist, that's family therapy, because many times it's not an individual that has a problem, it's the whole family. So we need to explore that possibility, because when families get involved into the problem that the target child has, everything is going to work much better. And when seeking a professional help, we also need to find out more about the psychopathological style.
Absolutely.
What is the style of the clinician? Okay. If it is going to tolerate religion and to favor religion, or if it's someone that is going to blame religion.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. That's very important.
Very important. After a short break, we'll discuss more with Dr. Melgosa. Stay with us. Welcome back. Today we are discussing the mental health pandemic and how families can help their children, teens, and young adults cope under pressure. So, Dr. Melgosa, what is the role of religion, religious faith, and religious coping in these processes? Earlier on, you mentioned something about religion and how some clinicians may respond to it. So what would you say about this?
Well, first I would say that whenever we need to choose a psychotherapist, we as believers, as persons of faith, we need to ensure that this professional is not going to deal with religion as a source of guilt, as a sort of repression, and so on, as the real cause of mental illness. We don't want that. In fact, it's not even current. That kind of thought is historically present in psychology and psychotherapy. But today, it's not a problem. Most clinicians will understand that religion is a great source of comfort for believers, especially. When I was preparing training as a psychologist in the 1970s, doing studies, doing any research that had to do with religion and mental health, it was forbidden.
Yeah.
Because it was thought of something that is not scientific.
Right.
But this changed at the turn of the century. In the year 2000, beginning of the century, I started to attend psychological meetings, and I started to observe with pleasure that there were studies about the benefits of religion and spirituality in mental health. So the interface between religion and mental health today is established. There is in the American Psychological Association one division that it is reserved for religion and spirituality. So it is widely accepted. Now, in practical terms, how is this going to help our mental health? Well, things like prayer, a scripture reading, the reflection on a Bible passage, family worship, whether it is in family or is individual as well, the certainty of salvation, how we are saved because Jesus died for us, the hope in his coming, they are factors in mental health because they will remove a great deal of anxiety from our lives. And then there are the virtues that sometimes are not religion. They are general, but historically they have belonged to religion, things like forgiveness, joy, resilience, serenity, positivity, contentment, love, humility, kindness, gratitude. Those are factors that make a great difference in mental health. And they have traditionally been promoted by religious. And there are other aspects that are more exclusive to religion. And that includes things like the certainty of the love of God for us, the salvation of Jesus Christ to our sinful nature. All those things are exclusive of religion, and they are also a great contributor to mental health. Current research is repeatedly showing that incorporating these habits of religiosity, spirituality into our lives is highly desirable to maintain good physical and mental health.
So basically what I'm hearing you say, Dr. Melgosa, is that we shouldn't shy away from religion, and that clinicians today are paying close attention to it. And in fact, they are acknowledging the fact that spirituality plays a positive role in how people mitigate their anxiety and just deal with the pressures of life, especially during the pandemic.
Yes, that is so. Let me give you an example. The generation of psychotherapists that we are having lately are people, many of them are postmodern people, that they have not lived religion. So I have seen in the professional magazines advertised, take a seminar on religion, how religious people feel religion, so that you can help them therapeutically better, because they don't have experience. So in that way, they will understand how religion supports to the believer.
That's excellent. And, you know, we were focusing particularly on students today, and you've shared that earlier. And you shared about that 8-year-old that was charging, you know, made a charge on their parents' credit card. How can parents help children to adopt these spiritual disciplines into their lives? I know that parents also need to model it, but what advice would you give to a parent of a student who's struggling and they may sense that they might be dealing with some depression or anxiety? What would you say to this parent who is a person of faith and how they can integrate that into their child's life?
I think it's very important that they spend time with the children. The remedies are not about telling them what to do so that they do, but rather spend time building up a relationship, being a supportive, listening to them, praying with them, and being available. This makes a whole of a difference. If things don't get better, then we have to look for help. But we'll be surprised how much it can help if we just are available, spend time with the kids, listen to them, play with them, do things with them.
I like that. And I think that's so important that our parents recognize that there are no quick fixes, that you cannot ignore the importance of time spent with your child. Thank you so much, Dr. Melgosa, for sharing with us today.
We'll leave you with a boost from God's word that says, give all your worries and cares to God, for he cares for you. And of course, that's found in 1 Peter 5:7.
That's all for today's Real Family Talk. Join us again when we'll share more about strengthening families and inspiring hope. See you next time.